Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from Litigation Conference Central, or FYP Studios East and West. Transmitting across the internet, this is episode 154 of Registry Matters. Happy Saturday, Larry. How are you tonight?
Doing fantastic. I am so glad that you were able to make it despite all the vast responsibilities that have fallen on you in the last two or three days.
I was incredibly busy with the conference, the litigation summit held by NARSOL. I guess I kind of turned into sort of like CNN and I didn't run the conference, but I was the guy pressing buttons, making the whole stream happen.
Well, from what I heard through my sources, it went off with very few glitches. It was a fantastic, the transitions were great, the speakers were great, and I heard it was a wonderful event.
I think it went off pretty well. I practiced really hard and trained and whatever. You know, I was like Mr. Miyagi and doing wax on, wax off. You may or may not get that movie reference.
I do not. The last movie I watched was in 1987.
I think, now come on, the Karate Kid came out before that. You crack me up, Larry. You crack me up so bad. What do we have going on tonight on the show?
We have listener questions. We have a case that's before the state Supreme Court in New Mexico. We have a case that's in federal court in New York where a trial court has issued a preliminary ruling. We have several articles that we may or may not get to all of them. And we have just general banter about all the things that have happened in the last week since we've been here.
All right. Where are we going to kick things off? Are we going to start with the New Mexico thing that you put in here, the Supreme Court? Is that where we're going to start?
Oh, let's do some questions. I know these inmates that sent these questions, they're just salivating for the answers. And Eric, thank you for sending your letter. He didn't have a question. He just had a compliment for the podcast about how he appreciates it. And he sometimes doesn't get the front and back because they scan mail at many institutions these days, and they don't let you have the actual papers.
Okay, yeah.
And he's not receiving the front and back, which I think he might ought to consider a grievance about that. But anyway, thank you, Eric, and it's always nice to have your support.
Very good. Thank you very much for that. All right, so here is the first letter. It says, Dear NARSOL, I'm not sure if this question will cover more than those impacted in the North Carolina prisons, but hope to get some advice from you. In this system, individuals with sexual offenses are not permitted to participate in various programs such as barbershop school, dog training, or inmate construction programs at minimum custody. These are the ones I'm aware of. Additionally, while inmates may participate in work release programs once they are 36 months from release, sex offenders aren't permitted until 24 months, and that's if we can even get in. Finally, at the camp I'm at currently, sex offenders will not be permitted promoted to minimum custody unless they've attended the SOAR, which is Sex Offender Something Treatment Program, with an extremely high wait list and low admittance rate. Would any of these be considered discrimination? Could I file a class action suit? And if so, how? Thank you very much for your help. We've talked about class actions before, and those are really hard to get. And would that even be the right vehicle to try and pick for this kind of operation?
It might would be, but again, the complexity of a class action, you have to get certified. There's too many people who think you just have a red stamp that says class action. Of course, you can go to most any office supply store that provides rubber stamps, and you could get such a rubber stamp printed. But that doesn't make your cause of action a class action. It's a certified process where you have to appeal to the court to certify the class, and there's commonality of claims, the efficiency of judicial economy, and the likelihood that those claims can be handled by the law firm. There's some standards to get a class certification, and they're exceedingly difficult to be certified. The states, the governments always oppose certification of a class because they would rather have you fighting individually, because your resources are more limited as an individual. But in his particular case, I don't see, I hate to be the messenger of bad news here, it is in fact discrimination. But the only problem is all forms of discrimination are not illegal. There's discrimination that's very much legal and can be done. There's no law that says you can't discriminate.
And we have to start talking about what is a protected class.
In prisons, there are very few things everything in prison is the, and I shouldn't say everything, let me back up. Most things that apply in the free world do not apply in prison. That's a controlled environment where people are being punished. And prison administrators are afforded a huge amount of latitude in terms of what they do. And those programs are considered privileges. Security levels are considered a privilege that you earn. Now, he's right that you can do the exact same behavior, and because of your offense, you will not be awarded that custody level, which would allow for you to participate in more programming. But the prison's argument is that they are under intense community pressure for those particular offenses, not to have it possible for people to walk away. And the last thing that prison commissioners, corrections commissioners for states, or wardens want is a microphone in front of their face saying, can you please explain to the good citizens of this community how this sex offender walked away from custody and just disappeared like a you-know-what in the wind? And they're not...
Oh, what, Larry? I'm sorry. What was that in the wind? I didn't catch the word. Maybe you broke up for a second?
We can't say that on a family program. But yes, I would say that I sympathize with him. The likelihood that finding legal representation is going to be a long shot, and even a longer shot to prevail on the litigation for those things. Although I would endorse and support it and cheerlead for it, I don't see those cases going. The better thing to do, which you can't do from behind prison walls, is to try to make policy changes where that the elected people of the state recognize that reintegration is an important thing, and then make it possible for more inmates to be allowed to prepare for reintegration in the community, which includes some of those things like he has on the list. I mean, I would guess if you learn to be a barber in prison, you might have a better chance of passing the barber's exam board when you get out. Maybe not, but I'm thinking that would be one thing. That's a skill that translates to the community, right?
I was just about to redirect back up there about the different schoolings that they may have in training programs, dog training and construction program. I mean, these are places that you could potentially get jobs. Can you help rationalize why they would then push our people back 12 months before they're even eligible to go into these programs? I can't see why a PFR can't go do haircut stuff.
That one doesn't, I can't opine, because if it's community sensitivity, wouldn't you be just as sensitive in the 24-month range as you were in the 36-month mm-hmm. range? Mm-hmm. I don't know, unless it's that they want to make sure you've done the treatment program, the SOAR or whatever he called it.
Right.
I've
often wondered that too, Larry. Why don't they, so I don't mean to take like the second detour, but why don't they put people in the programs to help them get treatment as soon as possible? Why do they get front loaded instead of back loaded?
It costs money.
I see. Well, all right then. Well, that answers all of those questions.
Well, I mean, that's a short answer, that all these things that the particular treatment costs money. And I don't mean to sound crass about this, but it's kind of like a case when people tell me that I don't like my case pending. And I say, well, it's a good thing if your case pending, because as long as it's pending, you're not convicted. And the good things can happen when your case is pending. The accusers can die. The mm-hmm. the principal witness can be transferred to Afghanistan and not be available to testify against you. Well, the same thing in prison. If you've got someone with a 10-year sentence and you front-load treatment and you've got all these people, we do have a certain mortality rate in prisons. Would you agree that we have a certain mortality rates in prison? People pick up additional charges while they're in prison for both for conduct behind the walls and for previously uncharged conduct. So why would you want to spend all that money?
I can see that, but then you end up with someone that may have some sort of good time, or you know, they're going to get out early for on parole or whatever, and so maybe that kicks their time back from that 10-year sentence. Maybe that kicks it back to 8 years. So then you would, like, by the time you then get in that program, oh well, you're not eligible for it until you're like 2 months out, 24 months out. You're already at the edge of you going home to begin with. So by the time they even let you become eligible for the program, then you could be getting out on parole. Anyway, it's crappy, Larry.
It is. Prisons are not great places.
That is definitely like an underlying theme of the show. Okay, so we're just going to title it Prisons Are Not Great Places, and we'll move on.
All right.
I'm sorry that there's just... So class action is not going to help out, and therefore, if so, how? So that would... Because that's going to be because of resources, and you've got to find an attorney to take it.
And
that's hard to do from prison.
Well, they're, when they don't see a reasonable probability of recovery, they're not going to take this on a contingency, because all they're doing is spinning their wheels, and they're not likely to gain any traction with this type of litigation. Mm-hmm. So the next question, we're going to concentrate on paragraph 2.
Okay. Yes. And this is a potential question for your podcast. I have been getting the RM podcast transcripts since August and have been reading the Narsal Digest since early 2018. One thing that I have noticed is that you haven't discussed SVP. What is SVP?
So I was on a different question. Are you on question 2 or 3?
Oh, you're on a different question. I'm on question 2.
Okay, I got it. You want me? I got it.
That's got it now? We're on the same page?
We're on the same page.
All right.
Old timers.
Oh, yeah. You've got that covered, man. Look at your picture. SVP is sexually violent predator. Civil commitment process very much during that time. I have an SVP trial coming up in 3 months and would love to get your insight on how to come out of an SVP trial successfully, because according to my public defender, SVP civil commitment is much like a life sentence. Is representing myself out of the question? Last but not least, what does FYP stand for? Thank you.
So,
should we start with the easy one first?
I don't even know we can answer the what does FYP mean.
So the quick story is, so you're there at home and you're sitting in your jammies and someone comes up and knocks on your door and says, I demand to know who lives here. Now, it is your task at home, the listener, to figure out and say, your response should be something that revolves around the letters FYP. Is that enough of a clue?
I think that is. Civil commitment. Now, in terms of let's sharpen a little bit. We're talking about sex offender civil commitment. Because purportedly only 20 states have civil commitment, because that's when people look at the sex offender specific civil commitment. But I hate to tell you, I do believe all 50 states have civil commitment. I haven't researched the statutes, but there's a process by which people can be civilly committed that are dangerous to themselves or to others.
But you're standing up on top of the water tower and you threaten to jump. They're going to put you somewhere for a few days against your will, and you're not being locked up. You're somewhere being civilly committed.
And they may seek a longer-term commitment based on what that short-term commitment yields in terms of your evaluation and whether you're amenable to a medication and can be stabilized. It could turn into a longer-term commitment. But with that standard, the standard is very clear that the person has to be usually an imminent danger to themselves or to others. And the goal of that commitment is to bring that person to a level which they can be released. We do not desire to hold people in this country in civil commitment. With the sexual offender specific civil commitment, the standard is atrociously bad for the person whose commitment is sought. It's rather than having the imminent danger to do harm to themselves or others, it's much more innocuous. They have to have a mental abnormality, is the boilerplate language that the states have used that have this process that makes them more likely to commit a sexual offense. And it's not exact around the 50 states. I didn't research California, so I can't opine specifically about California. But the mental abnormality is the catch. And then you end up in a process of which you have little control over because you've been locked up as he has been. He probably doesn't have any financial resources. And the state has virtually unlimited resources to seek his commitment. And the standard of proof they have to meet is a very low one, a mental abnormality that makes them have a higher propensity to do whatever that state statute says. And when you are committed, the goal is not clear that it's intended to release the person. So therefore, you end up like in Moose Lake, Minnesota, you end up with people that have been there for a very, very long time. And only a handful, last time I did any literature, read any literature, have gotten out. Very small number have been released. And that process was challenged, and the trial court found that it was unconstitutional, but it was appealed by the state of Minnesota, of course, and the Eighth Circuit said that, no, you have no right to get out. You have a right to a process that might let you out if you meet the standards. So this person, Theodore, he doesn't want to go in, obviously, because he's already served his time. And he's got a train coming at him with him having limited resources to fight with. He has apparently been assigned to a public defender, which I don't understand. This is a civil proceeding. So I don't understand why it was assigned to a public defender. That's something I cannot answer that. You know, this is not a criminal commitment. This is a civil commitment. He's finishing his criminal commitment, right?
Okay, I'm with you. So
this is a civil commitment. That's what it's called, civil commitment.
Okay, that's fair. I didn't really quite put that together, but I see how simple it would be to go civil and then civil. I'm with you.
Okay, so
put it together that way.
So, but the downside to a civil process is you're not entitled to free counsel unless the statute gives it to you. But constitutionally, you're entitled to free counsel when you're going to be put in the clink for a criminal. I mean that has not been expanded universally to include civil proceedings. And it may be that California has either put it in statute or there's a court ruling that says that the public defender shall represent those who are indigent. But there's another part of the component that goes unaddressed is that you need funding. Because if they're going to assert a mental abnormality, you may need your own expert to say that you don't have that abnormality. And that expert's going to cost money. And I looked at the state of Virginia, and they have a civil commitment process, and they do provide a modest amount of money. I think it was in the $1,000 to $3,000 range for experts for those whose commitment has been sought that are indigent. But that's another significant deficiency in our system is that we don't have the resources for these people whose commitment is sought. And then in the regular civil commitment, there's statutory build in the statute that reviews will take place at intervals. Like here, I think we have a 3-day commitment where you go back before the court, maybe 5 days, but there's a limited number of days. And then the person goes back before a judge with additional information from the mental health, from our state hospital or whatever psychiatric ward is evaluating the person. And they give the court a report. And the court is looking for a way to release that person in some kind of capacity, whether it be with required treatment in the community or whatever. We haven't made that clear that the intent of this so-called civil commitment is to restore these people to health so they can be released. And first of all, we don't even prove that they have anything unhealthy about their mental state because abnormality is not a criminal, it's not a clinical diagnosis. So he's in a bad situation.
Yeah, that sounds like an awful situation. And can we briefly circle back to roughly a year ago with Galen? I've lost his last name. He went through a civil commitment. Everyone was coming out of the woodwork to try and support him and help him. And how did that go for him?
Well, it didn't go so well. It was his second attempt. And what Narsil, we took a position that since he had not committed an additional sex offense, and that was in Virginia, there is a requirement that to be eligible for the commitment to be sought, you have to have a predicate sexual offense. And he did have a predicate sexual offense. He went through the process, and he was not committed. And then while under community supervision, he picked up some technical violations of probation, no additional predicate offense. And they violated his probation at the end of the sanction period, which I think was 12 months. Then they sought his commitment civilly, again, without a predicate offense. We stepped in and tried to argue that if there hasn't been another predicate offense, you do not get multiple bites at the apple. But hey, they went forward and they secured his civil commitment. And I think he's just recently been conditionally released from civil commitment. Yeah, I think I heard something through the grapevine that he has been conditionally released. We could follow up on that maybe next podcast. But he was found eligible and committed again.
Huh. I only bring him up because he didn't commit another crime to get him committed. And I'm not trying to paint a nasty picture for the question here. I'm just trying to, it's an awful system that doesn't give you, your favorite terms are about due process. And this doesn't provide you with a robust level of due process to defend yourself.
Well, it's weak on due process in the beginning, and it's weak on the due process once you're there. If you had the same robust reviews with the intention of getting these people out, that's what's lacking here. A robust review process that's geared toward getting these people out. And then back to what you said in an earlier segment, why didn't we front, if they really needed this treatment, why didn't we seek it in prison? This is actually a disguised attempt and successful, I might add, for the states that have it, which I think are 20 of them, to extend people's period of incarceration after they've given them all the incarceration they can in the punishment system as a result of their conviction. This, all it does is extends their confinement. And in many cases, the confinement closely resembles prison. Now, in some cases, it doesn't. They're clearly in a psychiatric unit, and it's a much softer place than prison. But some of the civil commitment is nothing more than a prison that they put a sign front called it a civil commitment center. And they're in the same type of facility as when they were serving their time.
Anything else before we bounce to number three?
And wearing the same clothing and suffering the same deprivation. If you're a patient, what rights you're supposed to be afforded as a psychiatric patient are different than when you visit someone in a psychiatric hospital. The deprivations are what's to keep them safe.
Okay.
But you generally get to wear your own clothing. You generally get to have a whole lot of things in the way of makeup and personal care items and things that they would never allow in a prison because you're being treated. You get to have more access to communications. And that's the way it's supposed to be, because you're not being punished. You're being helped.
Not cool. Well, then question number three comes to us. It's for the Narsaw Legal Corner. And did you want me to skip anything here or just run it?
Just go ahead and run it. It's not that long.
Okay. Hello, I have just learned of your publication today and hope that you may have some information that may help in my situation. I am serving a life sentence in Kentucky and have been litigating my actual innocence for 12 years. Under Kentucky law, a person under a life sentence is eligible for parole after serving 20 years. Another Kentucky law, sex offenders are not eligible to see the parole board unless or until they complete sex offender treatment, SOTP. Earned good time credits also require SOTP completion. A requirement of this program is that you must admit guilt. I hate that, Larry. I absolutely despise it. Failure to admit guilt renders you ineligible to take the class or pass the class. All statements made in the class are a matter of record for courts to access and have been used to counter actual innocence claims. Here is my question. Is there any litigation in place or being done to fight this requirement to admit guilt? False allegations and wrongful convictions happen, yet this requirement to admit guilt is forcing these people to choose a lesser sentence and chance for parole by admitting guilt, or face longer sentences and no chance of parole by maintaining innocence. Without good time credits, you serve 100% of the sentence day for day. It is wrong and coercive. Can't they do counseling without requirement that you must admit guilt? What are the effects of taking SOTP if not guilty? Thank you for your time and consideration.
There are so many good questions here. I'm gonna start toward the bottom. Can't they do counseling without the requirement you must admit guilt? I believe they could. Now, I'm not a therapist. I'm not an expert, so this is just a lay opinion. But I think you could do counseling for a person. But if the person is actually innocent, I'm not sure how they would benefit from that therapeutic relationship. I mean, unless you're just doing general insight therapy into a person's life. But if you're doing specifics about sexual offending and about impulse control and and thinking errors. I don't know how you would deal with thinking errors if the person doesn't have any. And I don't know how you deal with impulse control if they don't have any impulse control issues. So I'm not sure it would be effective. So what are the effects of taking SOTP if not guilty? I don't know because I haven't taken the SOTP program, so I don't know what the effects of that would be. I can't imagine that any treatment would harm you, but again, that's a lay opinion. Can treatment harm a person if they didn't do anything? Can you think of any treatment if you go to see a marriage counselor and your marriage is perfectly healthy? Does that counseling harm you? I guess it could. You could create problems that don't exist, maybe.
We have a treatment level person in chat, and they're saying yes, it could hurt you.
Well, then we need to mic that person up because, like I said, I don't feel qualified to answer that. But in terms of the litigation, I am not aware of any. But that doesn't mean there isn't any, because he raises valid points. But again, getting out of when you're actually being paroled early, which is what he's talking about. He's got a life sentence, and when he serves his entire sentence, they will let him out.
Okay.
I will assure you that.
Life being when he dies, they're going to send him somewhere.
Yeah, they will let him. but everybody doesn't have a life sentence. So when you serve the entirety of your sentence, whether or not you admit, they will let you out. And I need to qualify that unless they have a post-period mandatory period of supervision that follows your sentence. Then they may not let you out in some states like Illinois or New Mexico, because even if you serve all your time in those two states, they still won't let you out. But in terms of being early released on parole, that is a privilege. And to get that privilege, there are requirements for that privilege to be bestowed upon a person. And you have every right to maintain your innocence, and you have every right to keep pursuing your appellate review of your case. But I would just about bet they're going to continue to pass you up for any type of early release, because as far as the way they would look at it is you're in denial. And therefore, you can't be safely released early, and you need to stay in prison until you take responsibility for the acts which you've been convicted of doing.
I've just spoken to our resident treatment expert, and we are going to set up an episode in the future to go over how treatment could be bad.
Let's do that, because, like I say, I don't feel qualified. And if it can harm you, then we need to know about that, and we can circle back on this as soon as our expert is ready.
And maybe I should hold this, but I will just, me going to treatment personally, I didn't feel that I needed the treatment that they were providing. I made a thinking error, and the person that I went to discussed those kinds of things like cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, and just trying to help you go through those things. There was never really, my treatment never covered anything from like you did the naughty things with people that you shouldn't have done them with. He almost never went over any of that. It was about thinking errors and impulse control, like you just described. That, look, you can sit there and you'd be like, man, I'm perfect, but you could probably always improve your decision-making process. Anybody
Agreed.
Can.
Agreed.
So that was how I approached it. Look, man, I've got to go. I can sit here and cry and moan about it, and that probably would come back and bite me in the tuchus, or I can participate and try and look at it from a positive way, and then they'll report back to your handlers that you're doing great, and at the end of the day, everybody gets happy at the end, and somebody gets paid out of your pocket. Hey, what could go wrong there?
Absolutely. We're on a roll.
The next thing, I know it. The next thing that I have up is the New Mexico. Are we ready to go there?
Let's do it. This is fun.
All right. Let me see. Is there something I can quickly read that would give a description? Let me. Okay. I have section 31-21-10.1C requires the parole board to conduct a hearing where the state bears the burden of providing a clear and convincing evidence that the sex offender should remain on parole. There, that probably concisely states it, that they're trying to figure out who has the burden of proving.
So if you just read the questions I gave you, it'll go flawlessly.
Yeah. Okay, perfect. So the questions are, you people put an answer brief in the folder of a case in New Mexico called New Mexico versus Ryan Allen James Thompson. What is this about and why is it important enough to be discussed on this podcast?
Well, the reason why it's important is because it actually relates a little bit back to what we're just talking about. It's an appeal on an important part of law regarding what we call parole in New Mexico. New Mexico requires an indeterminate period of supervision that begins only at the conclusion of a person's sentence. You do not get early released here. And so you serve your sentence less any good time credits, which can be 15% or 50%, depending on whether it's a serious violent felony. And then after you've maxed out and I think killed your number, as they refer to it in prison jargon, you go into a period of mandatory supervision for a list of sexual offenses that can be from 5 to 20, or a couple of them actually are 5 to life. And the statute says after 5 years have passed that the person shall receive a hearing to see if they shall remain on parole, and that the state bears a burden of showing by clear and convincing evidence that they should. So Mr. Thompson was not afforded his hearing after 5 years. And that's what this case is about, is whether or not he should get a hearing.
And that problem is what?
Well, the problem is he's been on parole since 2013, but he's been serving segments of it in prison, because you can end up in prison at the front side of that period because they may not, the statute place the responsibility, just like they did in Illinois, of approving your residence on the parole board. So the parole board may say, nope, can't live there. So you've maxed out your time and you've got nowhere that they'll approve. So you're on parole because you've killed your number and you're serving your sentence behind the walls. You're doing what they refer to as in-house parole. So he made his parole by killing his number, but he had nowhere to go. So then when you finally get a place to go, then they're aiming and gunning for you, and the slightest technical violation will put you back in prison. So the parole board takes the position here that you have to have 5 years continuous in the community. And the statute doesn't say that. The statute says after 5 years of being on parole. So Thompson is arguing that he doesn't care where he was on parole at. He was, in fact, on parole for more than 5 years, and they did not grant him a hearing. Therefore, they have lost jurisdiction to continue to supervise him. That's what this case is about.
Did you work with the attorney that was going over this case?
I have actually worked with Kim Chavez Cook on a number of things. She is an appellate attorney with the state public defender, and she's also she represents the public defender's office in the legislature when they're in session. And we strategize on a lot of things, including this case, and we've really strategized on both how to fix the statute and in terms of what's wrong with the arguments that have been put forward previously by people, and which the judges cite back to old case law from the 1970s, when actually parole meant being released early, before we had determinate sentences. New Mexico switched in the 70s. I don't remember the year because I wasn't here, but we went from indeterminate to determinate sentencing. When we had indeterminate sentence, a person would be granted parole early, with good behavior and all the different criteria that went in there. So it was a privilege, as not a right. Now, the argument is, it's a matter of law. You've served your time. It's a matter of law. This is a period of community supervision. As a matter of law, they should release you. If they're not going to release you, it definitely counts toward the 5 years. And this is one of those situations where those who like textual interpretation, this is a mighty fine case for textual interpretation, because the statute is very clear. It says you shall receive a hearing after 5 years. It doesn't say 5 years of successful supervision in the community. Uh-huh. So their first position was it had to be 5 years continuous without violation. Then they backed off of that position, and they said it had to be a cumulative of 5 years, because that would still knock out people that served it in prison. They had that you had to have a cumulative of 5 years in the community. And The thing that's funny is that, you know, the trial judge, by what I was told, is a conservative judge, but he said that he couldn't think of a place where you got more strict supervision than in prison.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding.
he said that he couldn't think of any place where a person's more closely supervised than in prison. The district court found, this is on page 9, the district court found that no other form of parole is more greatly supervised than parole that is served in prison.
Can we back up for just a second? The way that you describe that is worded, that sounds similar to the Georgia statute with the 2 years shall be placed on unsupervised probation. It sounds like similar language.
It does.
Okay. I just want, so the word shall has a specific definition that says, like, it's not kind of a mighta coulda. It's not a, like, hey, maybe if you want to. It means you will do it.
It does mean that. And this is an example of when you have part-time legislatures that don't have a lot of time to spend on something, and the community is clamoring for something to crack down because of some imaginary boogeyman that's out there. It could be a boogeywoman, but some imaginary event that causes them that they need to act and need to act now. And they put this statute together without a lot of thought about the wording. But I'm amazingly a textualist when it suits the agenda. And had they wanted it to be 5 years in the community, they were quite capable of saying that, and they didn't.
Do I need to play the hypocrisy clip?
I have never claimed to be a rigid ideology when it comes to one or the other. Textualism can be fatal in cases, and textualism can be your best friend. That's why you should never religiously be one or the other. Textualism can be very bad for when we've done at least a half dozen cases on this podcast where textualism was led to a bad outcome. But textualism here is your strongest argument. If they had wanted it to be in the community, they would have said that. If they had wanted it to be violation-free, they would have said that. If they would have wanted it to have been, because the parole board takes the position that clearly the intent of the legislation was that you'd be able to evaluate how they responded to community supervision. Well, they didn't say that. Now, that is probably what they intended. There's no disputing that. That is probably what they intended, but they did not say that.
Right.
So why not be a textualist?
Right. I want to ask you, in the answer that you wrote of the question that we're on, it says, now that the case law is no longer relevant because this case is distinguishable, can you help me understand how you use the word distinguishable here?
Well, when you're a trial-level court, when you're arguing interpretation of law, you're arguing what the trial court is going to guide him or her in making their decision. So the state will always refer to a case named Edwards back in the 70s, where the Supreme Court said that you had no right to parole. They distinctly said that in Edwards. You have no right to parole, it's a privilege. And it was, as parole existed in the 70s, because it was something that you were granted in advance of your termination of your sentence date. But Edwards is no longer relevant in this case, and this case is clearly distinguishable, because what we have now is a person who served all their time. It's no longer a right to be released, and no longer a privilege to be released. Arguably, it's a right to be released because they've extinguished their debt to society. This period of post-prison supervision that we label parole only comes into play after you've served your time. That wasn't the case when the Supreme Court decided, like I said, I believe it was Edwards. We were sitting in the meeting in Santa Fe talking about this. That was the case that we looked at the most closely, and I believe it was Edwards. But that's so you distinguish yourself. You say, trial judge, the state is arguing Edwards. That's great, except it doesn't apply here because this case is distinguishable. And if the trial judge doesn't buy it, which this one did, but then the state, of course, appealed. We're at the state Supreme Court, not because of Ryan Thompson. with the state Supreme Court because the state does not want this to be decided the way the trial judge decided it. They do not want to hold these hearings. They do not want to acknowledge that people have the right to be released. If they're not going to be released, at least they have the right to have that time counted toward their computation of 5 years for the review hearings.
All right. Now, my limited ability to read these things, it seems that the legislature needs to clean it up. And I think you're saying that you agree that they need to clean it up. Are you the one that they should, like, you've said, if somebody's going to write a bill that hurts us, it would be better that you write it than they write it.
Well, it would be better. Now, the public defenders, they've got a lot of energy invested in this, and we're working collaboratively on language. We don't see exactly eye to eye, because right now it says clear and convincing evidence that the person should remain on parole. I want to not stop there. I want to say clear and convincing evidence that the person poses an elevated risk to commit a sexual offense if released from parole. So that gives the board something that they must cite to, that this person presents an elevated risk of committing a sexual offense if they are not continued under supervision. Because we need specificity, because otherwise they're going to say, well, I'm sure you could benefit from that. Actually, they have said that. They have kept people on parole. They have done exceedingly well with no violations. And they said, we think you can benefit from more supervision.
All right, then. Anything else on this before we cut and run?
I think we beat this one to death.
To death. Death, death, death.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
We have some listener questions, if you are, some like stuff that came from the website and then in also our Discord chat. You ready for that?
All right, let's fire those up.
All right. Brian in Louisiana says, Louisiana leper licenses. It's been 4 weeks since Louisiana Supreme Court ruled the identifier box unconstitutional. The state said they would have a plan in place in 2 weeks. I called the Office of Motor Vehicles today asking what the plan is. The representative said they received an email on 11/5 saying there is no change for now. Branded licenses are still being issued and that any change is on hold for a possible appeal. What is the status? What's the deal with that? I mean, if they were told to do something, shouldn't they go do it?
Well, that's where people don't understand the process, and there's nothing sinister going on here. When an appellate court rules on something, the case has to be sent back to the trial court for implementation, because it's the trial court that has the jurisdiction to hold the party in contempt for failure to comply. So there'll be a mandate that'll issue that'll come down. First of all, when the appellate decisions come down, they clean them up for grammar, for errors. Then the initial release may contain errors that get cleaned up. But eventually, after that process takes place, then there's a mandate that'll come down, and it'll be sent back to the lower court. And then there's a time period where the state has the right to notify of its intent to appeal, which almost always they do. And it would be my guess they probably would in this case as well, because that's just what they do. So therefore, since this case is not final, it is not final. The Supreme Court has ruled on it, but there's the possibility of asking for reconsideration. There's the possibility of well, not only reconsideration, that's really the one thing. There's also the possibility of filing a cert petition with the U.S. Supreme Court. And therefore, this case isn't final. And if the state is going to take an appeal, they're going to ask for a stay. They're going to ask the state Supreme Court to instruct the trial court to stay any further movement on implementation of this until the appeal is exhausted. I am not the least bit surprised. I know I got tarred and feathered when I said that I expected there to be no immediate change. But this is just the reality of what happens. And I would like to think that Louisiana would have an epiphany and they would say, gee, we probably shouldn't have been doing that. Now we've got something to hang our hat on. We're not going to do that. But that's not likely what they're going to do. What they're likely going to do is to try to figure out the minimum they can do to change the status quo. And while they're figuring, they might need to be using their appellate options to keep the case pending. They can figure out to come up with some legislation. I don't know when their legislature convenes. I don't know if COVID's going to impact what the scope of what they're going to consider. But they've got all these considerations trying to figure out how they can preserve as much of the status quo. And one of the things that can preserve status quo is to file appeals and to seek stays, to stay the implementation. And that would be what I would expect them to do.
Is a stay similar to an injunction?
Similar, yes. It's holding off on the implementation until the appeals decided. So it's similar to an injunction. It would preserve the status quo, and it's just not logical to think that the state that has arguably, according to that Supreme Court's analysis, the most onerous license marking in the country would epiphanize to the point that they wouldn't want to mark licenses at all. I mean, what would cause them to do that?
To then decide to not do it?
To not mark licenses at all. What would make them want to go from having the most extreme to having no marking?
Punish them and thump them over the forehead and say, you can't do this?
I mean, but the court didn't say that. The court said that they could do a less onerous marking. But I'm saying for them to devise a plan, which is what this listener is hoping for, that they'll have a plan for that they won't mark licenses. Why would they go from having the most onerous marking in the country to not having a marking at all? Why would you do that? Tell me what would move you from that point to that point.
Right. They're going to whatever degree they can, is just find whatever the line is, what they can get away with, and they're going to take one tiny little inch step back from whatever that line is of what they can't do.
That is likely what they will do, unless the people of Louisiana register complete resentment to their lawmakers that these licenses are being marked. And I don't see that happening. I do not believe the phones are ringing off the hook in legislators' offices saying, how dare you mark these driver's licenses? I don't believe that to be the case. Do you?
Right. No, probably not.
Remember, I picked on Louisiana and I couldn't think of his name last time I did it. Senator Vitter, who was the architect of the U.S. Senator Vitter, who ran for governor as well, I think. But he was the architect of the further reduction of people eligible for nutrition assistance. And he got great accolades in Oklahoma, in Louisiana for that position. And he would not have taken
people less nutrition
for further restricting the eligibility for nutrition assistance based on felony and sexual offense convictions.
And that sounds like a really great plan.
Well, my position is, if the citizens of Louisiana had registered resentment with Vitter saying, how dare you not want to feed a person because of a mistake they've made in their life, you're going to deprive nutrition assistance because of a mistake? How Christian is that? But that's not what the people of Louisiana did. He got great accolades his phones rang off the hook, but they were in favor of it.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, it's a very inhumane position to hold, but that's what we do here, Larry. That's the American way right there.
So, all right. So that answers that one.
Yes, and then we did receive a comment from what episode were we on? We're on 154, so this is from the last week's episode. It says, petition for mine. Oh, this is related to the removal from probation, terminating the sentence stuff. So petition for mine after 65% completed, denied, DA assistant opposed it, said a lot of negative things, even untrue things. Excuse me, saying I had thousands of pictures when it was only 300, according to the discovery we saw. Said I was the worst case in the history of the country, which was untrue, and just DA flair. My lawyer did everything you said. Probation rules here is they aren't allowed to recommend any SO for release. However, he told the judge I was a model probation person and that I was violation-free and have completed all my court-ordered mandates. He was very kind. I tried. But hey, I made it this far. I'm just happy not to be sitting in prison, and I'm with my daughter and my wife. Love the podcast, by the way. And hey, you forgot to say FYP, but I'll hold off on that part. So I almost have some level of like survivor's guilt to a certain degree, because if this person did all of the things, like it's very person specific. It is very probation officer specific. It's probation office specific, your county, your DA, the judge, the like so many things for whether you would be successful or not at having modifications done to any degree. And you know, it's unfair is really like the best words that I could use to describe it, that two people could have the exact same case, so to speak, and one of those pieces of the chain derail the whole thing.
Well, what I would like to zero in on is my lawyer did everything you said. I would like to question that, because if the lawyer did everything that I say, you would have known that they were going to say these things, because your lawyer would have had the conversation. The lawyer would have come back to me and say, they would have said, look, this is what they're going to say. This is, they're going to be their position. And I can go forward with your petition, but I'm telling you, if they say these things, Judge Smith is not likely to grant your petition. That's why I encourage this conversation. Most lawyers have their paw out for money and they want the full fee. And I'm sorry, I have to criticize lawyers, but I do. And what I would like a lawyer to do that wants to do these removal petitions, whether it be from the registry or whether it be from early termination, is to don't collect the entire fee. Tell the person, look, these things, particularly early termination from probation, are not rights. They're privileges. And I'm going to need to do some homework to find out if it's even doable. And if that lawyer had that conversation and they came back and told you, and if that lawyer told you that this is what they're going to say and you went forward, then this one's on you, because you should have known if they come in and say you're the worst case in the county and that you had thousands of images. And this is another reason why you can't go in to this pro se, because they're not going to tell you these things in advance of the hearing. You can't go in to the DA's office. First of all, they're not going to let you in. And second of all, they're not going to tell you you're the biggest creep that ever lived. And you need to know that before you go forward with these petitions, because in some cases, you're barred for a period of time from presenting another one, particularly in a removal or a reclassification. In yes. Arkansas, you have a certain amount of time frame you have to wait before you can file another one. You need to do your homework and get as many barriers out of the place as possible as you possibly can. What if that DA that did this was in the bitter reelection campaign? I don't know any of this. I'm just speculating. But suppose sure. The timing of this could have been altered, where it would have been decided after there was no judicial election that could have been a factor, or a DA's election that could have been a factor, and the DA might not have been as adamant. All those things are considerations.
Yep. Yeah, I would say that while I was still even like interviewing the lawyer the first time, he called over to the DA, and I don't remember which level. He didn't talk to the head honcho, I don't believe, but started just taking the temperature while I was still there to see if it was something that could be accomplished or not before I put a penny down.
And that's the correct way to do it. If you have integrity, you'll tell the person, you know, these things. Oh, you're in this county? Well, I'm telling you, they haven't totally terminated a sexual offense for entire years I've been practicing here. Now, you could be the anomaly, but they don't do it here.
Yeah.
And then you can go down the street and you can tell another lawyer the story who isn't honest, and you can buy into the hoopla that which is what people do. They accuse all lawyers
go,
of being,
go find be, someone that'll tell you what you want.
Being crooks, and they go look for the one that will give them the message that they're wanting to hear, and they hire that one. Because who wants to hear that I can't get off early? Nobody wants to hear that.
No, nobody wants to hear it. And I certainly went into it with that mindset. I don't want someone to lie to me and tell me that, oh man, piece of cake, and then obviously it fails. But I also don't want someone to say like, no, never does this work, and maybe it does work. I was like, how do you get past that cruft of figuring out where does the barometer lay on this actually being a plausible thing? It's hard to do, and it's, you know, we're lay people. We don't have the expertise that someone like you has, and we're trying to fly by the seat of our pants. We barely know how our car works, and we're asking a mechanic to help us, you know, tell us whether we need to get our car fixed, and it could be a $10 part or it could be a $10,000 job.
Well, if I could give this piece of advice, be willing to pay the lawyer for the time it takes them to figure out what you have and what your potential
yes.
is. That's all they've got is their time and their expertise. Be willing to pay for that. They shouldn't have to go talk to the DA for you on the off chance that you might hire them. But if they absolutely cannot win a removal petition, they shouldn't charge you for the full price for one, because they should be honest enough to tell you that I will do your petition for you, Andy, but not a single one's ever been granted. And I feel bad about taking your money, but I will give it my best shot. But I'm telling you, this is what they're going to say. That cost you $1,000 to find out. Had you rather pay $1,000 to find out that you're sunk, or would you rather pay $5,000 to a person who tells you that I do these all the time, don't worry about a thing, I'll handle it, and then you get sunk? And then you may be sunk for a period of time. Statutorily, you can't come back. Which is more preferable to you?
Nick brings it up exactly the way I think you should play this one. It says, for petition, the key is to have a lawyer who can make calls and get a good read of the room, who actually spends the time in that particular court and knows all the players. Yes.
Yes.
For something like this, you would want somebody that knows your local jurisdiction. You don't want some out-of-town one that's going to burn bridges. You want someone that plays golf with these people and hangs out and sends Christmas cards and whatnot.
You're absolutely right. The exception would be if you know it's an extreme long shot, and if you think you can break down a key witness and you need a person who's not afraid to do that, because if someone's gunning for you and you think you can break them on the stand and get them to be tripped up and to give conflicting testimony, you might win the case with an outsider. But generally speaking, that is exactly correct. You would want to. Basically, what you want to do is talk to me every time you have one of these and pay me to tell you. I'm just kidding on the pay, because I couldn't begin to talk to everybody who has legal questions. But you've got to find some way to talk this through with a person who's not just out to get paid if there's virtually no chance of you prevailing.
You should provide a service of where we hire you to interview our attorneys for us. There were crickets.
That's a good idea. What should that price be? $1,000 an interview?
Containers of fudge.
So I've still got fudge left over.
I'm sure you do. Thank you, Justin, for that. He then turned around and offered me, and I was like, no, it's totally okay. I was totally just picking on him about, I don't eat a whole lot of sweets. It's totally fine. I was just totally playing fun for that. You got something and I didn't. I was just playing.
So,
all right. Somehow we missed this one, Larry, but this one came up on the radar of different advocacy groups. So this one comes from Florida Action Committee. It says, New York Federal District Court grants injunction against the state blocking social media. But this is like a 2-month-old decision or something like that. And it says, a group of people forced to register as PFRs in New York have been granted a preliminary injunction by a federal district court in New York against the New York State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision, which sought to ban these individuals' access to social media. What's going on here?
Well, it certainly went past my elaborate detection systems here at FYP. So... We have a vast apparatus of detection, but this one got past me. But this is a statutory requirement for people under supervision, and it includes three categories. The victim of the registrant's offense was under the age of 18 at the time, or the registrant has been designated as a level 3 sexual offender, or the internet was used to facilitate the commission of the crime. And those people are restricted significantly from accessing the internet and social media. And the trial judge, this is in a trial court. It is not an appellate case yet. And I, for kicks and giggles, I looked up the district judge, because everybody wants to know, is it red or team red or team blue?
Right.
And this is a judge that was appointed by President Ronald Reagan.
It probably makes him team red.
And Judge Deary, I think that's the way that would be pronounced. And just like in Colorado, the Judge Mache was appointed by President Nixon. Now, in the days of Nixon, they were not very elaborate at doing They didn't analyze philosophy that much in those days at the trial level. They did at the Supreme Court level, but at the trial level, if the senators from that state recommended a judge, the president was someone for a federal judgeship, the president was going to appoint them. But this case is similar to what we had happen in Butts County, Georgia, where a preliminary grant has been given to enjoin the state, but he only enjoined them for the group of the internet which used to facilitate their crime. He decided that they are likely to prevail on the merits of this case. But I wanted to talk about the exceedingly high requirements for getting an injunction, because it's like the stamping a class action. That doesn't make it a class action. Applying for an injunction doesn't get, and in fact, most are not granted because of the exceedingly high standard. And the party seeking a preliminary injunction on anything has to establish that they're going to suffer irreparable harm and a likelihood of success on the merits when the case goes to trial, and that the preliminary injunction is in the public interest. And then there's another component to stay a government action. That the moving party seeks to stay a government action must establish that the irreparable injury and likelihood of success on the merits of the claim. And that's a tough thing. That's a real tough standard to meet. And then I really zeroed in on page 17 because it made me reflect back on International Megan's Law when the injunction was sought, and people threw darts and arrows at me when I said we can't meet the standard. And I couldn't find the standard, but I knew it because I had researched it before, but I couldn't find it. But thankfully, this district judge has a law clerk that could find what I couldn't find. And they say, Judge Deary says, irreparable harm is the single most important prerequisite for the issuance of a preliminary injunction. Quote, the movement must demonstrate an injury that is neither remote nor speculative, but actual and imminent, and that cannot be remedied by monetary damages. That is the reason why the injunction for International Megan's Law was doomed from the get-go, because everything that was being sought was based on speculation. We did not know what the marking was going to be. Therefore, all we could do was speculate, and therefore it failed. And I got mad. People got mad at me. I didn't get mad, but I just felt like that I was doing the best I could to explain to people the odds of prevailing. But this one here is a good case study for those who want to know about how difficult it is to get an injunction and why they are granted and why they're denied. And this case is still unfolding, hasn't gone to trial yet. We do not know how it's going to come out when it finally does go to trial.
Can you back up? You gave us the three different positions that people could be in for this for these conditions to be held true. And I just want to be clear, is it the people that use the internet to facilitate their crime, they are the only ones that didn't get this relief, or they're the only ones that did get this relief?
The way I read it, they're the ones who did get the relief.
That seems backwards.
Well, let's go back and make sure misread it. Let's make sure I read it correctly. So let's go down to the end of it, do a skim of the read it, because it could be that I have a bout of old timers.
Well, because to me, the people that you would seem to want to keep off the internet would be the ones that use the internet to commit their crime. The first one, it says the victim of the registrant's offense was under the age of 18. Well, they could have gone to a park to pick up the whatever. That doesn't have anything to do with the internet. Why would you restrict them from the internet? That's the only reason I'm asking this, because that just seems backwards to me.
Yeah, it looks like I've got it backwards. They're the ones who didn't get it.
You're fired.
Yeah, that's a bout of old timers here.
Okay, I didn't think that made sense, but hey, look, we're editing on the fly, and that's what happens when you do a live podcast. So, well, cool. Okay, so the people that use the internet to commit their crime, those are the people that did not get this relief. The other people where the victim was under the age of 18 or the registrant has been designated as a level 3 offender, those people are relieved from this, where they can still potentially use social media.
That is correct. And the another neat thing in this is the the overreach of Packingham, where it was a unanimous decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, but the conservatives were very reluctant because of the overreaching dicta that they said that would be used to drive wedges, and they were cautionary about that, and this came up in this decision here where the Packingham case was about people who had completed their sentence and were not subject to any form of supervision or punishment. They were being banned by North Carolina. And the court had some dicta that they were particularly concerned as how the internet ban was affecting people who had paid their debt to society, which suggested they were concerned about people who were still paying their debt as well because of the use of the word particularly. So that came up in here as well. But this case is still unfolding, folks.
Okay. But as we learned... with the Butts County one in Georgia with the signs, it is a very high bar to receive the injunction, but that does not mean that you can just tip your hat and say, hey man, we've got this, it's over, we don't have to do anything else, we've won. It could still come back and bite you.
They could come up with, because the court made it clear that they hadn't shown the evidence to justify what they're doing. It could be when this goes to trial they have more evidence like they had in Butts County. Well, of course, there wasn't a trial of summary judgment, but if this is resolved by a trial and they actually hear evidence, it could be that they present evidence. We don't know that because everybody moves for summary judgment.
Okay. We have some articles to cover if you want to fill in some extra time, and we're going to have to prioritize these because we have maybe 10 or so minutes to go, and we have like 45 articles to go.
All right, so let's do some articles. Let's start at the top, and the ones that are top on the list are more of a priority for me, and the first one doesn't take any time at all.
No, man freed from 505-year federal prison term. Larry, his release date, I stopped when I was reading this and laughed. His release date was July 8th, 2419. Who do you think is going to be running for president in 2419?
Well... But they would have released him after he did his time.
I don't mean to be laughing because that's an obscene amount of money. I mean time. I was just reading. He was a money launderer. Like he made phony money, Larry, and he received a 505-year prison term. But he's been released early. That's good news for the guy.
Because of the pandemic.
Oh, well, I mean, okay. But it's not like he's not somebody that's violent. He's not Charles Manson as an example of somebody that would be a threat to society, so to speak. This guy just put some money in the laundromat and then took it out and spread it around. That's all he did.
Well, it's not quite literally.
I know. That's a long time. 2419, Larry. Come on. You may still be alive.
Well, like I said, they would have released him in 2419.
Anything else before we, it's just a long time, Larry.
I like the next one about the wedding.
Okay. Let's see here. So this is the, from Courthouse News, Nebraska inmates fight Eighth Circuit for prison e-wedding. That's fun. I didn't really get enough information out of it. Is it just two people that were pen pals and they want to get married? I didn't really quite catch what the actual situation was.
Something to that effect. They want to get married, but the marriage statute from 1866, I guess, in Nebraska, contemplated that to get married you had to be present. And the state of Nebraska is saying that a virtual wedding doesn't count. And at the court, apparently the judges were like discombobulated. But why do you need? Why are you trying to keep these people from getting married? And we've had case law since 1966. You have the right to get married, but the question is, do you have the right to force prison administration to provide a platform and a portal for you to get married virtually? What right? The right to get married does that include a right for someone to facilitate your marriage for you?
Let me just. It seems like it would be easier to put in a computer to let them have a Skype wedding or a Zoom wedding than it would be to go through the security precautions of bringing a human body inside the walls.
Well, but they're not going to do either. I mean, that's the question I'm raising, and I don't have the answer. I'm saying you have the right to marry who you want to. Where is it etched that you have the right to force prison administrators to provide you transportation or security if physical presence is required? Where is it? What right can you cite that you have the right that they must force, that you can force them to provide a platform for you to get married virtually? If we want to be textualist, what can you cite to that says while you're being punished that they must provide you the avenue to get married?
And remind me, Eighth Circuit, that is the appeals court, that's one step below the Supreme Court?
That's correct, and that runs down the midsection. It would be Nebraska, Arkansas, Minnesota, that midsection of the country.
Okay.
But I'm wondering what right can you cite to it? You can get married all you want to. As soon as you're out, you can go get married.
Okay. And that would then put the burden on you to find somebody to marry you, justice of the peace or a minister of some sort to marry you. You go to some sort of establishment to do it. But the prison doesn't have to do that for you.
I don't know. That's where...
Right.
If you are a textualist and a literalist, then this would be legislating from the bench for the people wearing the robes to put in to issue an edict from the bench saying that the legislators should have done this and they didn't, therefore we're doing this. That's a little bit of legislating from the bench. So I'm just wondering what right you have to force the prison. You can't force them to provide you access to your doctors. They provide you access to the doctors they want to provide you access to, right? You can't.
You don't get to go, hey, look, my special doctor over here, that's who I'd like to go see. FYP. No, you can't go there.
You don't get to force them to provide you access to visitors of your choice. I mean, you do have some limited visitation rights that you can forfeit depending on the discipline, but you have severely curtailed rights in prison. So I'm just anxious to see what right that they are going to be able to assert. And if the Eighth Circuit invents a right, because I think they'd be inventing it, what they hang their hat on if they say that the prison has to do this stuff. And I'm not taking a position on it. I'm just raising the question.
Yeah.
If I were a prison administrator, I think I would probably try to create, without a court telling me to, I would probably try to create something. But the prison would take the position. This is what an administrator would say. Well, if we start providing these virtual weddings, they're going to become commonplace. And that's all we're going to be doing. And there could be sham weddings.
We are not the Department of Marriage.
well, they're gonna say that there'll be sham weddings that people will have met through writeaprisoner.com and Friends Beyond the Walls and all these websites, and they're gonna say that people are getting married to try to get benefits. What happens if a person's that's 72 years old? Well, you gotta be 60 something to be on Social Security. But what happens if a person's in their 70s and their benefits to Social Security have been curtailed because they're incarcerated, which happens whether you're on disability or whatever form of Social Security? What happens if a sham wedding happens for someone who is in a financial condition that they can collect spousal benefits by being married? Now, I don't know all Social Security law, and I don't know how long you'd have to be married, but what happens if people use it to scam that? Would we be happy that our prisons are accommodating sham weddings?
Probably not. But if only you would think of this. I shouldn't say only you. Somebody else would too. But you are the one that would think of these things.
What would happen about people who want to sponsor folks to come in? Suppose they're in prison for something other than a sexual offense, and they could receive a monetary consideration for a virtual wedding for someone that they've never laid eyes on before. I mean, would that make you happy as a society? I mean, there are downsides to all these things, and I'm just curious how this case is going to come out. It's going to be fascinating to me. That's why I sit here.
Yes, of course. And then we have a pair of articles, at least they're tangentially related, from the New York Times. Sex abuse claims against the Boy Scouts now surpass 82,000. And the other one is a $73 million settlement is reached in sex abuse suit involving UCLA gynecologist. I don't know why you put these in here.
Well, we do tend to talk about stuff related to sexual offending. And what I put it in here for is because I'm totally confused. And I don't understand. We've talked about former House Speaker Hastert, who was molesting the wrestlers apparently for a long time, and he admitted, it's not my speculation, he admitted when they charged him with money laundering and all the stuff they charged him with doing, he admitted that he had done that when he coached wrestling. We had Jerry Sandusky. We had Dr. Nasser. We've had on and on with these high-profile cases of people that I don't understand what happens, how this stuff goes undetected and undisciplined and unprosecuted for years and decades. I don't get it. I don't want to believe just because someone comes forward that they're automatically guilty of every accusation that's made. But on the other hand, at some point, it becomes a pattern. And if you're paying out $73 million at UCLA, I would say that there are a lot of, in this case, it was women. It wasn't like with Sandusky and Hastert, it was boys. But there are a lot of people who have been victims and who have been reporting things, as we found out in Penn State University, that the administration was aware of this and they took no action. How does that happen, Andy? How?
I don't know. I don't know.
I mean,
but 82. So, are some portion of those 82,000 claims? Some portion of those are probably not true, but some of them are probably true.
I would guess in any situation where there's money to be had, people will put forth dubious claims. I mean, that's just human nature. Hopefully they have a process of ferreting out that the people were a member of the Scouts. I'm sure they do, because money's at stake, and they have some process of validating. You'll never be able to know what happened. All you'd be able to know is the person was a Scout under that particular Scout Master in that particular era when those allegations were made. But again, you would have a pattern. If you only have one Scout that comes forward, and that's all, and that's not to negate that could be true, but if 27 Scouts come forward from one Scout Master and report something, at some point, you ought to take it seriously, I would think.
You would think. Anything else here before we go on? We could probably do one more if you want to, like, pick one.
Pick one. All righty. So, well, you know, the war on drugs.
Did you want to do the war on drugs?
Yeah, let's do the war on drugs.
So this is from The Hill. 50 years after the start of the war on drugs, Americans have a chance to fix the harm it created. Richard Nixon is the one that is accredited with starting the war on drugs. Public enemy number one. How can you imitate how Nixon would say it? Public enemy number one. I don't know. I can't do Nixon.
You did a pretty good job, actually.
I have heard people like bashing Vice President-elect Kamala Harris for her position as DA back in California, whenever that was, as being incredibly harsh on people coming before her for drug crimes. That's what I've heard, and they're wondering, is this all going to change when she steps into the office and all that stuff?
Well, I think you heard me bash her because I posed that question when she was running. You know, is she truly different now? But this is clearly, these two articles indicate that we spent a lot of money and not achieved a whole lot. The deaths from drug overdose have gone up as the public has voted. In this recent cycle of election, this general election, the conservative and liberal states have voted to relax. It's bipartisan. There are states that you would not think of that are voting to decriminalize and legalize the use of drugs. And I think we're finally turning the corner, but it's going to take some time to unwind because a lot of people make a lot of money. And they don't want to give that money up.
You think that this is based, like, so we'll call this the war on drugs industrial complex, perhaps?
Absolutely. It is a big industrial complex. And a lot of money is made. And the cops are one of the biggest opponents to legalizing drugs. I'm sorry to tell you that. I know that we have an audience that tends to love the police, but they fight tooth and nail. And they use scare tactics because and some of their scare tactics are legit. I mean, but they over-dramatize the complications of smoking a little bit of weed. It's not a gateway drug.
Certainly for that one.
Yeah, it's not a gateway drug, in my opinion. And that's what they say. Hell, this is just the beginning of what's coming. If we legalize this, what's next?
Except for we still have alcohol, which is, from my understanding as a layperson, is far more harmful and leads to alterations of personality where people get drunk and they turn into completely violent, crazy people. That's not your gateway drug? Okay. All right, then. But that one's legal.
So, well, we're only skipping three articles, so we did fairly well.
Not too shabby. Let's see. What do we have to do to close this thing out? God, I don't think we got any patrons. If we did, I am sorry. It was a really crazy busy day, and I didn't even have a chance to look. But, Larry, how do people find the podcast?
They search online.
Search online. Awesome. Smoke signals. I think I keep using that one. Let's see. What can we come up with? Teletype. You were probably around when the teletype was invented.
So registrymatters.co will get you to our site, and you will find every episode we've ever done, right?
I think so. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. If not, it may have started like around episode 5, but I'm pretty sure you can go back to episode 1. Yeah, you can go back to episode 1. Yes. So. And what about your favorite way of phone calls if somebody wants to call in the old-fashioned way with the rotary or the touchtones?
That would be 747-227-4477.
Email is registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And we love all of our listeners, but our patrons make this so much more fun. And you can find that over at patreon.com/registrymatters. And you can support the podcast for as little as $1 a month. And they get the fabulous transcription service that pretty much Larry runs. Do you want to quickly talk about that just for a brief moment?
I do. I'm hoping that sometime early in 2021, we're going to have our entity created. I've been hesitant to do all the work that's involved, but we'll have a business entity and we'll seek our 501c3 status. And we're hoping to be able to drop the cost of the transcripts, which I'm hoping that even if before I may be able to drop it, because we had anticipated that they were going to be using large envelopes and that the postage was going to be running higher because we didn't have the formula to keeping it concise to the number of pages that we can get into to the process we're using now. So we may be cutting the cost of the podcast transcripts a little bit, and then hopefully as we get donors under the 501c3, we can reduce it to free for people who are indigent, and we can reduce it even further when we have more financial support.
Groovy. Man, that's awesome. Larry, as always, I appreciate your time that you spend here on the podcast, and I know that the listeners do too. You are an immense amount of knowledge, and I look forward to next week. It'll be right after Thanksgiving next week. I hope everybody has a good Thanksgiving holiday too, and if you're traveling, please be safe and wear your damn masks, right?
Fantastic.
Great. Have a great night, Larry. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.